building a dream. And so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done, brother. Can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done, brother. Can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell. Full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we look swell. Full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? Call me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
I think we'll go right into the next one. Tie in with Olaf as well. This is rather a tango. It sounds like a dance, but it's actually movie music from a film called Le Moulin Rouge, Boulevard of Broken Dreams. The singer sings, "We walk along the street of sorrow, laugh tonight, cry tomorrow. You'll find me always walking up and down. I left my soul behind me. I just can't keep the joy." And other lyrics as well. I think this is very famous song from about the same time during the Great Depression. Sure. Early movie music. Thank you.
there I thought wet with tears of hell a broken dream. Here is where you'll always find me, always walking up and down. But I left my soul behind me in an old cathedral town. The joy that you find here you borrow, you cannot keep it long, it's me. But jiggle, oh, and jiggle that, still sing a song and dance along the boulevard of broken
I have our special collections. This one, American Song During the Great Depression, has titles such as Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries, In the Still of the Night, On the Good Ship, Lollipop, The Gold Digger's Song, The Unemployment Stomp, All in Down and Out Blues, 15 Miles from Birmingham, I Ain't Got No Home in This World Anymore, The Death of Mother Jones, White Cliffs of Dover, etc. and so forth. What it says about the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, this song is a splendid example of another piece more somber, more serious than most songs of the time, perhaps indirectly reflecting the mood of America during the Depression. Stormy Weather by Harold Arlen and Ted Kohler is perhaps the most famous song of the song. A lot of romance, a lot of cheerful songs as well, but I thought that these two more clearly showed the depression through the eyes of some of the characters in the book. Comments? What did you hear of Olaf that came through?
I think his sense of betrayal by his friends and everything that he, the people that he worked with, and you know, like all this time that he tried to get a job, all the people he wrote to and everything, he said they wanted to help him, and then it got to the point where every man was for himself, and I don't know, I think he felt like, sort of like, what happened, you know, kind of, he didn't really understand.
It said we laugh tonight and cry tomorrow, and Olaf was always so optimistic for so long. He just kept trying to be optimistic and every letter, and he kind of had his ups and downs, but finally he gave up.
I think Olaf was kind of like representative of the average man during the Depression, because he showed, what society of men were going through, and it kind of showed them, like she said, the ups and downs and the changes, and I think he was put in the book more to show, to represent all the men. Kind of like a figure.
What happened to Russell when Olaf left? What did his mom say? What was going on with him?
So when he became like the man of the house? It looked like she was going to be married.
So she sort of lost hope too at that critical point, didn't she? But what do you remember of her at that time?
I remember Russell feeling that it was her last chance.
But he didn't really know anything about it until afterwards. Until when he read the letter, it's not like she knew the rule was that. It was mostly in hindsight that he noticed, his mother had lost hope, and she was like Olaf, they lost and going down and not interested in
most of the things I'll talk about later on. But one thing I did want to say is that listening to the music in some ways is a lot more powerful than reading a book, because it goes deeper into you. Music can go deeper into you than words often. And it's hard for us to conceive of a time that was as hopeless as most people felt then. And try to imagine, if you can, what it was like for every dream that you had, everything that you worked for, everything that you had acquired in your life to be taken from you. And not just taken from you so that now you had to work again to bring it back, taken from you so that you couldn't work again. There was nothing else you could do. There was no place to go. Not all your friends were in the same place. Your bank was down, the stores were closed, the food was more expensive than you could afford. There was no money that you could come up with. Your family was in turmoil. Everything that you recognized and knew and based your whole life upon, all of your values were just torn up and cast to the winds. It's a difficult thing for us to imagine because we've grown up in such wealth and security. But in some ways, that's the kind of thing that made Russell Baker what it was. That's the kind of thing that made our world what it was. And as you're reading the book, try to imagine what it was like and how that might have affected Russell. And see how he talks about it in the book and what ways, what methods he uses to address those issues.
The next piece is called the NRA Blues. Does anyone know what NRA stands for at all? NRA?
National Reconstruction.
That's wrong.
National Reconstruction Act.
Okay, and who was one of the very famous politicians at the time that they were talking about?
FDR.
Okay, what happened with that poster? Remember?
They put
Hoover.
Truman.
Was it Truman?
Or Hoover? No. And then there was sort of the battle between the two ideologies of
the landlord against the renter.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had this people who had power and people who were struggling. Just read you briefly about this, the NRA Blues. This is recorded 1933 in New York. This is not a protest song, it's rather a praise song by Bill Cox. And he's a dedicated member of the Democratic Party. He celebrated Roosevelt's re-election in 1936 by writing and recording "Franklin Roosevelt's Back Again," and "The Democratic Donkey is in his stall again." Despite its title, this piece, the NRA Blues, is not a lament. It praises the agency for its attempts to combat unemployment and other evils of the Depression. Country music audiences had no objection to such a partisan song, since support for the Democratic Party and Roosevelt in particular was strong among people from these regions and classes where country music was the natural musical dialect. The song is a white blues, like Uncle Dave Macon's song, with structural and harmonic patterns derived from Anglo-American folk song. So even though it says it's a blues, again, this is all music that would be listened to by white people. The black groups were doing their own blues in their own styles as well, and we had people like Leadbelly and others. But right now, I think what's important is that we listen to what Russell would have listened to. Some of the lyrics that I pulled out amidst the harmonica and guitar interludes include, "I work down in the old sweatshop. When are you going to join the NRA? When payday comes and I get my check, all I get is a little respect. When are you going to work for the NRA? You, when you do that, you'll work short hours for the same amount of pay." So it's sort of the initial request for support for that and very union.
What is the NRA?
What is the NRA?
Yeah, I don't really know.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know what the National Reconstruction Act was about?
Right, yeah.
It was an act that basically the government would employ people to do things that were necessary to be done, building roads, building railways, doing public service projects, planting trees, working for the National Forest Service, and in fact even artists were employed to, they would paint murals in post offices, and it was just a way of getting a lot of things done, putting a lot of people to work, make them work in ways that were dedicated to the community and the culture, as opposed to just sort of going out and getting a job at the local diner or whatever.
Just,
so they could spend it and get the economy.
Get
sweet thing, sweet thing. I work down in the old sweat shop, work for a few and never stop, sweet thing. Yes, baby mine. When you gonna join the NRA, sweet thing, sweet thing. When you gonna join the NRA, I never have heard the big boss say, sweet thing. Yes, baby mine. I've got the blues.
WPA, you may be familiar with that, Works Progress Administration. They built, for instance, dams down by Tennessee and huge forestry projects, sidewalks in New York. You walk into post offices some days and you see these old murals. And that's
most of them have been repainted, however, because they were very sort of leftist in their political leanings, and when the sort of the shift to the right happened in the 50s, people got real offended by them and painted them over.
Does this music remind you of any music that came later? Or any singers? It's a certain genre. It's not dance music, is it?
It's like political, like Bob Dylan
that type. That reminds me of the 60s.
You got it. Yeah. People came after were Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and Alan Lomax and other people who not only sang but went into places like Appalachia and the South and recorded music of the quote-unquote down and outers, and that kind of music came into our culture and became acceptable after the Depression, after we got tape recorders and after we learned that there was more to our culture than just the straight white middle class. And we got into blues, we got into jazz, we got into all these strains from different cultures besides our own. And the book alludes a little bit to foreigners. I don't know if you remember his mentioning of his friends coming from the other side of the tracks, the Italians.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few songs related to foreign elements coming in, because there was a lot of competition for jobs, so this sort of aggravated. The next song ties in with another theme of growing up. It's called The Little White House. And I just wanted to read you a little bit about it before we get into it. The date of this is 1926, so we're backing up, but still I think it ties in with what happens when Russell's mom meets Herb. During the first third of the century, most Americans took the dream of owning a home seriously. The basic dream was often supplemented by a desire to reside quietly away from the overcrowded, older, dirty city. Such dreams came true for many during the prosperous years of the post-war decade. That means just after World War I. The fantasies were not diminished because everyone else seemed to have a little white house in the new developments, or that green blinds and white gates were to be seen everywhere. Inside the little white houses were mass-produced sofas, chairs, dining room sets, bedroom suites, kitchen ranges, wall and floor coverings, electrical fixtures, and bathtubs and flush toilets, all of standard patterns. Could one really be an individual with so much sameness? It did not matter. People clung to the notion that one's own home was unique. To a large extent, they were right, and the desire to live in moderate isolation still persists vigorously. Relatively lower-priced homes and mortgages at reasonable rates, however, provided honeymooners of the 20s with better opportunities to translate into their reality home on the outskirts of town. The phrase is virtually without meaning in today's megalopolis. Despite its spare lyric content, Little House conveys the sense of joy in having the best of all domestic worlds, privacy at the end of Honeymoon Lane, and an entrance that would welcome one's close friends and perhaps even a few genial strangers. It was the commuter's idea of the house by the side of the road. The image created by the song's simple words, together with equal simple melody, give the number an appeal that carried beyond its original theatrical setting. The song, well recorded, was a hit. So the little white house at the end of Honeymoon Lane. This is 1926. There's a whole section in the book describing the new house when they move into it. Do you remember that section? Mm-hmm. Try that.
That helped him get a start. I love him so because I know he wants to do his part. He's an A1 in the Army. He's an A1 in my heart. And just in case you're quizzical, I'm going to tell you now. He's passed the toughest quizzical. He's passed the folks in hell. For I know why he rates so high on Uncle Sammy's chart, because he's an A1 in the Army and an A1 in my heart.
Feeling joyful about it, but think about the difference now. When we listen to that song, Do Right, what was it saying about men and male roles? And what does it compare with what this one is saying about it? To make it short and sweet, that when men's roles were sort of annihilated by the Depression, they were worthless, they couldn't get a job, they couldn't support their families, many men just sort of abandoned their families because they didn't know what else to do. Now the war came. The revival of masculinity, they can save themselves, they can save the country at the same time and make themselves feel confident one more time by picking up the arms and going and shooting people. I think it's a real important thing in terms of what the culture is about, in terms of how men reaffirm themselves in this one particular way.
Most of the war-related tunes were essentially love songs. Among them, I Threw a Kiss in the Ocean, Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, that one, with anyone else? And I'm Getting Tired So I Can Sleep. The best specifically war songs were When the Lights Go On Again. This has ties to Golden Village. And There Is a Star-Spangled Banner Waving Somewhere. Goodbye, Mama, I'm Off to Yokohama. A novelty song focused on an enemy who was obscure and inscrutable to most Americans in 1942. By tradition, Americans were primarily oriented to a transatlantic world. Historical experiences in the Far East had been generally troublesome, and the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor confirmed the worst popular notions about the Japanese character. The tragic events of Bataan added to the belief that the Japanese were not only treacherous, but inferior. For some, the defeats stimulated dreams of revenge and glory, and Goodbye, Mama aptly sloganized the attitudes of blue-eyed civilians and green recruits. This song, I'm going to read the lyrics so you can see how amazing they were, symbolizes the attitudes of a lot of people over there. This buckaroo never looked for scraps, but goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for the red, white, and blue, my country and you. Just to teach those Japs, the Yanks are no saps. A million fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please, will get those Japs on their Japanese. Did it? Okay, so it's really one of those amazing novelty songs, and it's something that is very typical at the time, just before and after Pearl Harbor, where they had a lot of news blackouts in the West Coast. You couldn't find out what was going on, but you certainly could dance to this song in the canteens. Come up with quick lyrics, record it fast, and get it out. Chip song.
This young buckaroo was Yankee through and through. Then Johnny heard our country's call to arms against the Japs. And as he marched away, his buddies heard him say, goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my red, white, and blue, my country and you. Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama just to teach all those Japs. The Yanks are no sacks. A million fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please. We'll soon have all those Japs right down on their Japanese. So goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my country, my flag, and you.
Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for the red, white, and blue, my country and you. Goodbye,
yeah,
Mama,
really ties in
I'm off to Yokohama just
same
to teach all those Japs.
No kidding.
A million fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please.
Ties in with one of the slides that Orange showed us.
So goodbye, Mama. I'm off to Yokohama for my country, my flag, and you.
This also ties in with Russell Baker's description of why he went to fight. Three reasons. Do you remember them? They're hysterical. I'm not going to tell. I'm too embarrassed.
Learning to fly is another metaphor, by the way, that you might think about in terms of how that relates to Russell Baker's growing up. One thing I want to do is relate this a little bit more to our contemporary lives. We think about what this meant for people then as they were saved from the depressingness of the Depression. Well, in some ways, we suffered a kind of psychological, if not military, defeat in Vietnam. What's happening now with the sort of rise of that military spirit? What does that mean? Well, how is that a repetition, perhaps, of the same kind of pattern that we saw before? The neat thing about looking at this kind of history is we can find cycles repeating themselves over and over again if we look hard enough.
One of the most, did you have a comment? Sorry. One of the most powerful songs of 1942, which you may know the lyrics of just almost by accident, was invented, apparently inspired by an exclamation of Navy Chaplain William McGuire at Pearl Harbor, but the story has been denied. Some clergymen denounced the song from the pulpit, but that did not impair the tune's great popularity. Another story about the song is that Kay Kaiser recorded it at one day's notice as a result of a telephone call from Loesser, who sang it long distance. Kaiser liked it and put an arranger on the phone to write down the words and melody as Loesser sang. Band rehearsed and recorded it in Hollywood the next day, July 31st, 1942, the same day they recorded the equally popular and irreverent strip polka. At the last Kaiser recording session before the Musicians Union's prohibition against instrumental recordings took effect. That is, the big bands were told, no longer, we go down to small groups. Save money, save everything. The story seems plausible as the Library of Congress did not receive Loesser's music until August 21st. Here it is. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition and we'll all stay free. Praise the Lord and swing into position, can't afford to be a politician. Praise the Lord, we're all between perdition and the deep blue sea. Yes, the Sky Pilot said it. You've got to give him credit for a son of a gun of a gunner was he, shouting, praise the Lord, we're on a mighty mission. All aboard, we ain't a-going fishing. I don't know who wrote these words, but praise the Lord and pass the ammunition and we'll all stay free. Repeat last four lines to end. So you get to hear the famous pass the ammunition song.
The song sucks.
Cartoons teaching them how to go to war.
You said something about Vietnam, the Vietnam War, and I think it's really interesting how during this time, like all of the television and all the, you know, everything was so let's go America, you know, and how it kind of made the public believe, you know, that line of thinking that, you know, war is great and everything like that. Whereas the 60s after the Vietnam War, a lot of the, there was that really bad attitude to the Vietnam War, and just think about how the media and all the songs during that era really denounced the Vietnam War. So it's kind of interesting how, you know, the public thinks, I mean, it's controlled by this.
Yeah, well, there were protest groups, and there are a few protest songs for even in World War I, if you listen to, you know, some of these records, against intervention, but they're pretty much quelched, and you get blacklisted. And when you're blacklisted, you cannot use a recording studio. You cannot play, you cannot associate with other musicians. And many of the musicians who were blacklisted didn't survive, and some did, and some of the few have maintained their stance through time.
Another
so
issue
there are two strengths throughout time.
Another issue, too, is that the media played a very different role relative to the government in the 60s than it did in the 30s and 40s. The government had a great deal of direct control over the media. When they didn't want anything to be known, nobody did anything about it. There was all kinds of stuff that was really squelched, where in the 60s the government lacked that authority, so the media could do what they wanted to do.
Well, but when you've got a blackout, you've got a blackout. No.
But I'm talking about even before the war. One thing, too, is that you think about the news photography, which is the thing that sort of made the spirit of Vietnam be what it was. The newsmen would send their own people to Vietnam, they'd run around and they'd do videotapes and film, and they'd come back and they'd show it. In those days, you could not get to the war zone unless you were approved by the government, and then all of your film was censored before it was released. And if you did anything that they didn't like, they would not only kick you out of the news correspondent crew, but you often, as Kate had mentioned, could not get a job anywhere else until long after the war was over.
those of you who have cassette recorders, I have this tape of more songs from the 30s and 40s, starting off with Why Don't You Do Right, but also I've Got Rhythm, All the Things You Are, and Nightingale Singing, Berkeley Square, Love Me or Leave Me, and the famous Ink Spot singing Java Jive. Most of these records are a little, you know, fuzzy, but you still can understand the words on them, and I really think they're fun. Also, if you want to listen to these records, they're available for checkout. You'd have to listen in this room because the phonograph's in here. Songs of World War I and II, Inventions and Topics in Popular Song, Come Josephine and My Flying Machine includes not only The Little White House at the End of Honeymoon Lane, but If I Had a Talking Picture of You. And Take Your Girlie to the Movies, and Hello Frisco, and The Argentines, the Portuguese, and the Greeks. And Mr. Radio Man, Tell My Mammy to Come Home, Irving Berlin, etc. And then songs during the Great Depression, I Ain't Got No Home in This World Anymore, and early Woody Guthrie, The Death of Mother Jones, again, this other element coming out of people really canonizing Mother Jones, and she's becoming more popular now in these days than before. White Cliffs of Dover, the Gold Diggers song, We're in the Money Now, Unemployment Stomp, In the Still of the Night with Cole Porter, and Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? So if there's anyone who wants to listen to those, they're available.
To childhood and childhood issues, our own childhood issues, and one of the best ways I know of doing that is to stare at yourself, stare at images of yourself. And so this is what I'd like to do, even if it seems rather formal, and although you have probably already done this to a degree as you have selected these pictures, but I want you to take 2 minutes and just stare at your own face in your picture. Those of you who do not have a picture, try and remember a picture that you have. You can remember. Borrowing one won't do. So take 2 minutes and stare. Now, not just staring and some sort of looking at eyes and looking at noses, but trying to use that as a kind of portal into remembering who you were, remembering what it was like, remembering what your childhood was like, and remembering not so much in remembering events, we'll have plenty of time to do that, but also to remember feelings. So let's take those 2 minutes right now. Do with these free rides is use these as more resource material for helping you out with the shrines. Hopefully this afternoon we'll be moving our materials all into the, is the dining room?
I think so. We need to just double-check that with that
one. And if that happens, I think what I'd like to do is to figure out a time and maybe I can meet with those of you who are interested in just getting a little bit of hands-on experience of how you make boxes, how you fold cardboard, and how we deal with the materials we have, just to sort of figure out where you are. So I'm willing to help with any technical problems you may have, almost any time that you may have them. But basically, I don't want to give you information if you don't need it. So you have to kind of communicate to me what it is you need and what it is you want. And then, if I can, I'll satisfy your needs and desires. One other thing I want to say, too, is that Kate and I have a lot of information to give you, as you probably already know. And oftentimes, we may not provide enough space for conversation or for sharing something you may want. So feel free to interrupt when necessary to raise an issue, talk about something further, or talk about something, your own sort of comments or whatever during class, just to make sure that you knew how to do that. Well, now we enter into the time when we talk a little more formally about this book. So one thing I think I'd like to talk about first is just raise a few general questions and see if you have any answers for them to help us get the most that we can out of it. I guess the question I'd like to ask more than anything else is, what is this book about? Well, obviously it's about Russell Bacon, but it's also about a lot of other stuff. So why don't you answer that question for me? What did you find this book is about?
How our observations of other people affect our own personalities, our being. He was always talking, you know, about the different uncles and about what he thought about each of the uncles, what they did, what the aunts did, grandmother, mother, and how, you know, a little bit of each one of them seeped into him. He didn't comment explicitly, really, on how it affected him, but you could tell.
Okay, about the power of observation, and so Thanks, Johnny. Good. What else?
It was just about growing up and seeing all the outside influencing factors that we really don't, we normally don't look at, but he kind of observed and wrote about them in kind of a simple way, you know, so that we might look back and kind of look at our childhood and see what subtle factors influenced us.
Okay. Who had their hand up first? I can't. Someone just jump in.
Ultimately having to be satisfied with ourselves. He looked so much at how his mother formed his life, sort of, but then he had to take steps and do what he needed to do to be happy with himself, and it wasn't necessarily what his mom wanted for him.
Okay. How would you sort of describe that? Is there a word or two that you could use to...
Probably.
Anyone want to help out with a word or two to sort of encapsulate that?
Happiness comes from self.
Well, let's call it asserting ourselves, because that's sort of what he had to do in there. Okay, Junior had a...
Sort of like that, how his mom sort of predestined him much of his life, at least in the early years, pushing her values and her dreams and her goals of making a good man. And she couldn't find anybody else. She just found, you know, she concentrated on him and how that determined his life.
Okay, so independence, too, might be another way to sort of put those guys together. Okay, I think I saw some other hands up in that direction somewhere.
I felt like he was... I was trying to think about what he had to do to write this book, and it's like he probably had to go way, you know, back in his past. I guess that's what I see. He's going backwards in time to write this whole thing. He's delving into himself, and he's also like... It sounded like he probably had to do some research, maybe, like talking to other people... relatives and things. It's like a going backwards in time for him, as far as he can go, even further than that, and then coming up to where he is now, or, you know, as far as it goes. Working with memories, maybe, and things in the past.
Okay, so in a way, it was like a real sort of personal kind of experience for himself.
It's almost like he relived his life with different. Maybe with the blinds off, so to speak, as he, in retrospect, you know, went back in his life.
What was Sitka, what was one of the recurring cycles that you noticed that he brought out?
There was the one between when Miss Elizabeth, when his mom married, when Miss Elizabeth married the husband. The mom, Ida Rebecca, was like totally opposed to it, and real, these two strong personalities fighting over this guy who was sort of standing in the middle of the world, whatever, and not being as strong. And then he brought home his girlfriend, and it was, I mean, they both Russell and his mom saw this fight again between the strong mother-in-law wanting to protect her little boy and her little baby, and from this nasty hessy type girl, which is, you know, I mean, the grandmother thought, and Rebecca thought that about Lucy, that she was kind of, she was just a little too flippant, a little too city-like. So there was
but
that.
You know what? I don't think if it would have been any girl, I don't think it would have mattered.
Oh yeah,
you know what
no,
I mean?
exactly.
Because I think that she was so attached to her son, and he was living so much for her that
definitely.
If it would have been the nice, sweet little hometown girl that was innocent as could be, I
who was living for whom?
Well, actually, he's living for her. I mean, she is putting her dreams and goals and everything, like Jean said, into his head, and it's like, okay, go for it. Take it away.
She's living through him.
Yeah.
Something I thought was cyclical was when she you know, married her husband to try to change him from his alcohol, you know, dependence on alcohol. She wanted to change him, make him a good, you know. And that's not like that. She was trying to do the same thing with Russell. And it's like she hadn't learned her lesson with her husband. First husband.
What is the lesson?
She was trying to change people for what she thought was good, the best.
Okay, let's track that down a little bit. She's trying to change people. What does that mean then? What is the struggle that's going on?
She's not satisfied with herself.
Possibly. But let's see if we can nail down what the struggle is about. We're talking about cycles. What happens between Ida, Rebecca, and Lucy, Elizabeth? What is it between the two of them? What is it between Lucy, Elizabeth, and Russell Baker?
Well,
What is it between Russell Baker and his and several of the other people that he meets? What is the power? What it's a power struggle is what happens. Mm-hmm. What you see before you is an analysis of how power plays out in Russell Baker's life, and what the implications of that is, what the implications of that is. What other cycles do you see since Kate brought that up?
Also at the beginning of the book, he talks about how it just happens that your children never want to know about your past, and you're never anything until you're a parent, and you don't have a past, and that he did the same thing. He didn't really know. He was just their kid, and that was, you know, and that he talks about how everything is sort of a rope that's all pieced together. It's not just, yeah, it's not from diaper to shroud, I think is what he said. It's that everything goes together, and that the parent's future is in the child, is the child's past, and the child tries to make it the past, tries to make the parent's future the past, and it's over. But so each, it's like each generation is kind of living through
sort
each other.
Facing
all,
in.
Yeah, and the one wants to deny that and move forward, and the other's trying to move forward with them, but the one ahead feels caught by that.
Okay, and that's a kind of a cycle that's repeated in a kind of spiraling fashion throughout the book. Well,
I think that also ties in with the personality of the grandmother affecting Russell, personality of the mother affecting Russell, and Russell affecting his kids. So even though you say, well, my parents had a major effect on me, you think about their parents having an effect on them and some of the same messages. You know, have some gumption. And what does Russell tell his children? You're sitting there at the supper table. What does he tell them?
Something about you got it so easy, your life is, wasn't it, growing up in the 60s, and that they just had television and we didn't even have television.
When I was a boy.
Exactly what he sort of criticized his own
the same messages. Yeah. Finish everything on your plate or else.
Okay, let's sort of get back here too in terms of a few other major issues before we get into some of the real specific ones here. Is there anything else that you think this book is about?
I see it kind of, after you said the thing about the little deaths and births yesterday, and thinking about that, that seems to be what the whole story is, other than whenever he comes to a new person, he tells about their past, but each event is, he's bringing it up because he remembers it because it was a little birth and death, and the thing when you got long pants and something, and going into adolescence, or all these different things. That so by writing the book, he's seeing all his little births and deaths of what made what.
Mm-hmm. That's another one of those sort of cycles that happen. You said all these sort of little births and deaths keep recurring in some ways, coming back. But each time they come back, they're at a slightly different point than they were before. A constant kind of movement. I think one of the themes that I would call that is change versus changelessness. There's a constant movement, a kind of rhythm to the book. But there's still a sameness that keeps happening. In fact, he does that structurally in the book. If you notice that first chapter, when he sort of describes his mother as being sort of set free from the chains of her past and sort of set free in time, and all the sort of, he sets up the book right there in that first chapter. I can read you some quotes later if you'd like, but he comes back at the very end of the book where his mother doesn't remember who Russell and Mimi are, and she just falls asleep as a kind of a way of tying that back together again, tying this braided cord one more time, creating another cycle that is bigger, the bigger cycle that starts with the cover of the book and ends with the back cover of the book. So there's all that same kind of flowing going on.
I want to get back to the power struggle, what you were talking about, because you never did say, I don't think you ever really did say what you exactly wanted us to say. You said, well, let's define this or whatever, and I don't
okay.
think you really did.
All right, you want to try it?
No.
Lisa, do you have any feelings or emotions about it? Did it strike you? Did one person stick out in the book that you had a reaction to regarding your power?
I don't know. I felt like a lot of my childhood, I still feel like this too, that I'm living for my mom. And I don't know if that's me or if that's her. I mean, I guess it's got to be both of us, you know. But so I mean, I can really relate to what is going on with Russell, just because, and it's not, I don't see it right now as being, I'm just beginning to be able to see the negative part to that. I mean, I have always thought that that was fine. I mean, I didn't have, it wasn't like, like in this book when I'm reading it, I can see how his mother is affecting him, then it could be a detriment to him, you know, and to her. But I have just, like, over the course of the last probably half year or so, been able to see more of how my own relationship with both of my parents has been sort of disrupted for me. I guess that's kind of, I don't know, it's hard to face that when you don't want to with your parents.
Sure.
In fact, Russell talks about it oftentimes, of the pain of confronting those transitions. I think that another theme about the book that is what happens to Russell as he grows up, which is partly part of that power struggle. The word is used over and over and over again, how Russell describes each time he reaches that point when something happens. Do you remember what that word is that he uses to describe what happens to him as he grows up? He becomes something each time in steps. He becomes skeptical.
Yeah.
He talks about his skepticism. He talks about what, in fact, if you could say what growing up is for Russell Baker, is that it's becoming skeptical. It is losing trust. The first time he talks about it is when his father dies. Remember what his quote is about that? Let's see if I can find that here in my... Unfortunately, my book and your book is not the same, so it's not going to have the...
Same page numbers.
The same page numbers here. But... where is that now?
Yeah, his coming of age is tied in with losing trust, not only in his mom, but also in women as a whole.
Well, his first trust I'm talking about is not about people. His first trust is about God. Let's see, where is that now? I'm having a hard time.
He says that it was harsh. That's the word he uses. To take his father away.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have that?
Is it Uncle Harold?
Oh, here it is. It's in the large format book. It's on page 61.
What chapter?
It's in chapter 5. He said I would understand someday, but she was only partly right. That afternoon, though, I couldn't have phrased it this way then. I decided that God was a lot less interested in people than anybody in Morrisonville was willing to admit. That day, I decided that God was not entirely to be trusted. Then he goes on to say, after that, I never cried again with any real conviction, nor expected much of anyone's God except indifference, nor loved deeply without fear that it would cost me dearly in pain. At the age of 5, I'd become a skeptic and began to sense that any happiness that came my way might be the prelude to some grim cosmic joke. He goes on to talk about that. It's a real powerful kind of section of the book. So he repeatedly goes through that. When he later on was talking with his uncles, and suddenly he realized that his uncle was a liar, that one of them will never amount to anything, but all of them are sort of hangers-on. He starts realizing other things. And then, in fact, the uncle that's the big liar, he goes through another kind of transition and starts realizing that it doesn't matter that they're lies, that their stories, the stories themselves, have a kind of personal value. Okay, so skepticism. One of the things that we talk about with a power struggle, in terms of relationship too, getting back to weave those two together, is that most of our parents don't want us to become skeptical. How many times have we sort of expressed a degree of skepticism to our parents about perhaps their values or their decisions, and they say, boy, you're really becoming a skeptic, aren't you? Power struggle is a way of imposing one person's values on another. It's a way of controlling them. It's a way of making sure that's not always negative in the sense that no one wants to hurt somebody else, theoretically. But you always sort of want to control. Parents do that. They do that to help you, but sometimes they don't know what their real motives are. But that's part of what the power struggle is.
And the mother would always say, for your own good.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure your mothers and fathers have all said that to you one time or another. Well, since I mentioned that, then what else happens to Russell Baker as he gets older? As he becomes more skeptical, which is what he thinks growing up is to some degree, what does he lose as he gains skepticism?
Idealism.
Idealism, certainly. What else does he lose? Actually, I think I already read it to you, if you remember what the quote was.
Couldn't cry anymore.
He couldn't cry anymore, so he got his skepticism kept him away from stealing.
Maybe just the basic sense of difference, you know, in the child in you that most people have, maybe even as adults.
Well, how would you what is the thing that we call innocence or the child in us or naivete? What might be a word to describe that? When you see people now as an adult, they seem to have that quality about them.
Acceptance,
openness maybe might be a way through. Okay.
Being vulnerable.
Being vulnerable. Okay. He says that he loses the ability to love. He says that he can no longer face the idea of love without also anticipating a great deal of pain. So what he gives up is he gains his ability to grow up, as he gains a degree of capacity to experience life, to fulfill the expectations of first others and then himself, as he loses the ability to love, the ability to feel, the ability to be open, the ability to be vulnerable. He eventually catches them back again, and he very subtly weaves those into the latter part of the book, but that's sort of one of the things he uses as a description for growing up. I think Kate already mentioned something about his relationships with women, and I think the book is very, very specific in repeated ways. Could anyone describe what women are to Russell Baker in his life?
Either good women or bad women. Bad women are okay to hang around, you can only marry good women.
Okay. Well, how would you describe a good woman and a bad woman based on Russell Baker's terminology?
Good woman is like her mother, her grandmother, somebody that all order you around, is respected, and a bad woman or a woman who's fun to be with.
Kind of like his mother's view on men. There's good men.
Yeah. Well, let's get into this in a little bit. Catherine, you had your hand up. Mm-hmm. Or Christine, sorry.
He always said that the good women never had any sexual connotations or anything.
Okay, so good, another good.
I know he said something about how bad women are kind of sexual connotations. And I kept thinking over and over again how there's no display of affection in them. I think because there's no affection, he's got that feeling that.
I think good women were motherly figures, and you couldn't imagine having any left for your mother. And since a good woman was like your mother, you can't have any left for a good woman.
Well, I think we brought up lust, which is a really good point. Let me sort of give it another word. Let's call it passion. It seems to me, looking at the way the rhythm of the book, there is very little passion in it, except maybe toward the end. Except in the early section of it, there's one thing. Before his father dies, there's that one little part. Do you remember how he describes that passion during that time? He describes, excuse me?
The part between the one boy met the girl who kissed and fucked
her. No, I'm talking about before his father died. It's an important part, I think, of defining the idea of healing, which some gets lost when his father dies, but before that. Does anyone remember that one part?
When he runs back to the house, he can't.
It's just before that, but yeah, that one real important section. He describes passion as fleeting summer storms. The summer storms of passion that come and go. In a sense, there's a kind of rhythm there that leaves his life when his father dies and never comes back again. Maybe that has something to do with the difficulty he has later on in being able to integrate those issues.
I agree with what Chris and Christine were saying, that it's sort of present or not present, black and white. There's no gray. And because it's so extreme, he feels very awkward about it, and he whatever his emotions are feels like lust. And you can't allow much tenderness or friendliness in him. Real scared for him to be vulnerable, so he puts it off on the woman. She's there. Mm-hmm.
How is it that he develops his own idea about women, particularly? What does he have to do in order to do that?
Break with
him. How does he do that?
Break down.
He starts doing it before he goes to
the
hotel. Italians is one of them, yeah. That's a real good one. Where are the other ones? The school. Could you describe anything about mm-hmm. the school part? Do you remember that one issue in the book when he talks about that, the Latin lesson? What does he have to do in order to gain independence? He has to be cruel.
Mm-hmm.
That it's such an issue that's so difficult for him that he has to manifest his independence through cruelty. Not one kind of place. Where else does he try doing that earlier? Asserting his independence through a kind of cruelty.
Could it be that fight? I forgot who it was, but you know, he was on roller skates, and that bully hit him and he shouldn't have. And then to finally his friend held him back while he got rid of the fight. And you know, inside you hear him saying, oh, I wish they would just be not get over with and stuff. But he actually, yeah. I mean, he fought him down. Would that be it?
Well, yeah, he became the aggressor, the one, the bully that switched roles, just like he switched roles with his mother.
I think when she would punish him and went to the belt, and he would cry, he'd say, you know, a couple sentences, says the truth, until she finally breaks down.
And cry.
And then what happens to his resolve then?
But it totally breaks down. He says, it's okay, Mother, you know, I won't do it again, and everything.
Now let's go back to the Latin lesson. This time he knew that he affected his mother. He saw that he had hurt her, but what does he do then?
No sympathy.
So he sees slowly in developing his independence, and one of the things that he has to do is to battle, this battle of wills means that it has to be his love, essentially, and his release from that love gets expressed first through cruelty. And, we talked about that cruelty. But he also learns gentleness from real love, too. You know who he learns that from? Anyone have any ideas where he gets some of that gentleness back?
Herb.
Pardon me?
His stepfather.
Herb, right, the guy he sort of really hated and resented at first. How did that happen? Do you remember?
He was trying to show his approval to her, like at the dinner table. He would just totally leave her out of the conversation. And then later on, her was trying to show Russell that he was a good person by asking if he wanted to go to the ball game, he wanted to go get some ice cream. And then I guess it ended up at a card game and his mother lost. Telling Russell that you know, he let his wife win just so he would be happy. And so, Russell punched him.
That's another metaphor I might add. When you read this book and you sort of are done with the book, and most of you are sort of mostly done with it, and you think back of what kind of feeling you get about the book, is there any word you could sort of use to describe the feeling? Or a sentence will do. A paragraph.
Maybe a struggle for freedom.
Does it get freedom at the end?
Kind of. I mean, yeah. But not without the person. His mom refused to acknowledge him with me.
Yeah, it was kind of like depression, loss of hope, and then renewed hope, just like the book went through. I kind of went through that too. Almost like the bicycle he got for Christmas, kind of, you know. Usually when you start reading a book, you know it's going to have a happy ending, and you think it's going to have a happy ending. And, then you're kind of reading along, and he knew he was going to get the bike, and he tried to forget it, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're thinking, oh no, it's not here, I'm not going to get my happy ending, I'm not going to get my bike, and you just kind of get depressed, and, you know, you're not really liking it, just one bad thing after another, But finally, you know, things do work out all right, in a sense. Some good things do start happening. They do get their little house on the end of Honeymoon Lane, and he does finally break away and marry Mimi, who wasn't a good woman in his mother's eyes, but was the woman that made him happy. Finally get you, it's like,
I think his release comes in his accepting the way that his mother is when she's old, where he says, when he started out trying to say, no, my name is Russell, no, we're here in the hospital, no, you've been here for 3 months.
Reality.
And then he gradually saw that he could change that, and that seeing her happy was letting her go with her, or going back into her past. So he didn't change or try to change that any longer. So he wasn't trying to dominate his mother now, when he might have had the advantage. Rather, he just released that into
the personality is just like a metaphor for the book. I mean, she went freely back in the past, and so did she in the book.
Okay. Back to your hand. Right. When I think back at the book, one of the things that I think of is intimacy. Despite the fact that Russell describes his family as not being particularly tactful, it gives us a very intimate look, not just in terms of events, but also in terms of relationships and in terms of Russell Baker's view of himself. Only a very secure person can talk about himself in such terms as Russell Baker talks about himself. And I think what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about what we know of Russell Baker before we get back to some of these other things. What we know about Russell Baker, what we see, how he describes himself, and how we can sort of use these as a way of looking at the book in a broader perspective. So, how do you think, looking at the book in general, Russell Baker describes himself? What do you know about Russell Baker? Who is Russell Baker? Yes.
He doesn't like pain from other people.
Okay, he runs away from pain whenever he can. What else do we know about
him?
Okay, he tends to be a little bit timid, especially as it comes to women. So you might say that he's passive. What else do we know about Russell Baker?
He knows all along that he's good at writing. It's like he knows all along parts of them, but he denies them a lot. Something at the beginning doubts.
Right. He's just filled with a sense of self-doubt and lack of self-worth. We'll get back to that issue. It's a real important one too. He's afraid of not succeeding, which is part of that. He's always being told that he must succeed, that he has to have gumption, he's got to go out there and do something, and somehow the context that is always brought to him doesn't seem right, and he always avoids it. He always doesn't succeed, almost as if it's on purpose. What else do we know about him?
I think he likes creativity, fantasy, and stories, and it says a few times that he fantasized about being a pilot. And he'd listen to the stories from his uncle all the time. And he'd read some books, Land of Oz, and so I think he liked creativity.
Mm-hmm. So that's real true. I would add to that it shows that he's very sensitive, very observant. I remember some person once asked me, how did he remember all these details about his childhood? And as Brent said, he obviously did a lot of research, but still, he must be a very sensitive person to have that as a resource to go back to, so much of it seems. What else about him? What's the feeling you have after reading all this? And a lot of this is circumstantial. He doesn't go in and tell you things. He implies things about him. He may be the central character in the book, but most of the time, he doesn't tell you specifically about how he feels.
Back about the thing about success. He feels that he doesn't think he can make it. I think he really has he sees it as being other people's success, and that he's just forced into it. And that he, and then that way he can't succeed in his own way, even if he does follow through with that, and that's where he gets his power.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
So, even if he were successful, he would doubt that it was his doing, right?
So at first it isn't. Remember the first story? Who wrote his first story?
Mom. So he can't get there on his own, is what you're saying.
Or even just the, you know, the successfulness is that you do good and that you make something of yourself. And that's so put on him that you think that that's the most important thing. That maybe he's avoiding it. He doesn't want to accept that he can make it because he doesn't really think that that's, he doesn't believe in it as much as everybody's saying this is what you have to do.
Is it maybe put up in such a, on such a plateau, it's such a big thing, it's so important that you make a thing of yourself, and look at this guy, you know, he was a failure, he didn't do that, and you're not going to do that, you're going to make something of yourself, that it almost scares you. I mean, it's like, do it or die. And if you get caught, so you try it, but if you get caught failing, honey, forget it. So why put your foot out there?
That's sort of fear of failure. Why do you suppose it was so afraid of failure?
It was built up. The way she looked at, the way his mom looked at and said, look at this person, you know, for not like his uncle, for becoming a failure or whatever.
Well, what might have been a model that would have helped him sort of be afraid of failure?
His father, his relatives, just in general. I mean, you know, he has this uncle that lies and thinks of all these fantastic stories about him making all this money, and he loses it all. And the dad tries to do stuff that is taken by diabetes and fails, and he can never become a good man because he drinks, and just all these nails. His mom doesn't really succeed either. His mom wants for so long to have a house. I mean, she eventually gets it, but she never succeeds in making a good man and stuff. And Olaf seems to be this guy, and he fails. And Herb wants to be an engineer, and he succeeds to some extent, but he's never put on as a permanent engineer. And he's, you know, they just, all these people around him never quite make it. And so he doesn't think that he can quite make it. Like when he goes to Johns Hopkins, he got a full ride scholarship, but he doesn't see it as that. That's an incredible success. It's like the gods gave it to him. And even when he's there, he doesn't stretch out. He just doesn't think that he can do it. He's kind of like, it's sort of a fluke, I'm here.
Let's change the word success a bit. Let's change the word to confidence. Mm-hmm. Because I think what he's looking for, I think the issue that happens is not so much whether someone is successful per se, although that's there, mm-hmm. It's whether they're confident in what they do. The word confidence comes up several times in the book. But certainly, Russell's worried about his own confidence, repeatedly. He's surrounded by male models that are not particularly confident, whether it's because of themselves, whether it's because of the time. Herb's the only guy who is confident. Herb's the only guy who really sort of feels good about himself, for that matter. And in some ways, that's what Russell is struggling with. There are, it seems to me, in the later part of the book, three very important lessons where Russell proves his competency to himself. But one thing about it that seems to be important as well, when I think about it, is that Russell seems to have things happening to him. So, in fact, he describes it as things keep happening to him. So these three events are very important. One of them is swimming. He wanted to learn how to swim. He never could quite learn how to swim. How does he learn how to swim?
He was told, he was ordered to jump off the diving board.
He was tossed in and he either had to sink or swim, as they say. What did he learn by that? What happened to him? What kind of transition did that mean for him? Okay, so what's the word then about going forth to see if he can do it?
Take risks.
Take risks. Russell Baker never really takes many risks. Most of the time, the only time he takes a risk is when he's forced into it. And then it's not his risk, it's someone else's. this is the beginning where he starts realizing his own competence. He realized he could have always swam if he took the risk. What's the other time then? What's the other time where something real important like that happened?
Flying.
The flying. Okay. Now he's helped by his hangover. But nonetheless, he sort of gets his kind of... What does he do in order to get that intimate reaction to this machine where he actually feels a kind of meditative oneness with it? What does he experience?
Relaxed.
Calmness, relaxedness. What is another word that you might use? Peace. Pardon me?
Feeling of power.
Feeling of power, okay.
Confidence.
Confidence. He's open now to experiencing the feeling of what it is, rather than trying to deal with it intellectually, rather than trying to imagine all the connotations, rather than trying to have control of his ship, he becomes one with that ship. He allows himself to not think. He allows himself to be. If you remember now the third important one, and that of course is Mimi. How does he finally deal with Mimi? I mean, after all that struggle of being a real jerk, something happens somewhere.
Oh, no.
How does it happen? What is the thing that makes that thing happen with Mimi, at least as Russell Baker describes it?
He feels jealousy.
Well, jealousy comes before that, but I'm sort of after that a bit. Christine.
He's a loser because he's just leaving and he's going away and she's not going to stay around for him.
Okay, let's move down the line a little bit. I'm talking about the time where they do all that walking. And one little section where they're going to the museum and he's spouting off and he sort of starts walking her home. He has a great realization at that one point.
He has a sense of power that he's educated and not someone that he can give her.
Okay, and then what happens right after that? Something very important that is a repeat of what happened in the flying experience.
Well, she tells him her life story, and he learns that she has a past, that she's just not his creation, that she was there before him.
And what does he do as a reaction of learning that past?
He wants to be a protector of her, shelter her, be the man.
Okay, that's the, really the way it comes out. What happens is, first he realizes he's in love with her. And the second thing is, because of his love, he doesn't want anything from her. He no longer wants to be invited in to sleep with her. He no longer wants any of that stuff. In fact, he doesn't even want that kiss goodnight anymore. And what happens with Mimi is she reciprocates the love. So the thing that happens at that point is surrender. The thing that happened in swimming was surrender control. The thing that happened in flying was surrender trying to have control of the ship but be the ship. The thing that happens with Mimi is surrender of trying to make something happen but to experience what happened.
And also accept it.
And accept it. Exactly.
Another point that I noticed earlier in the book was in high school when he wrote that paper, he was so unconfident that he was waiting to back up feeling great. And then he gets it back, and the teacher received from the class, and he was so proud. And he felt like finally he had done something by himself. So
right, and that's another example of surrender. Because he didn't know what he was going to write, couldn't figure it out, and said, oh, what the hell. And out came this spaghetti story, and there it was, almost like it happened automatically.
Well, he said he surrendered himself, and he just became a part of that paper. He left part of himself like that.
Let's move back to I forgot who had mentioned the point when he's talking to his mother, and lets go of needing to sort of be anything, surrenders himself to the trips in time. And once again, through that powerful surrendering, he experiences his book, essentially. And it gets to experience his mother. So when I look back at this book, let me sort of, I don't want to keep, I have a lot to talk about here, I want to talk about some of the themes. When I think about the book, I think of the book not so much as freedom exactly, but certainly a kind of release, a release that comes through acceptance and surrender. What it starts out with a very complex system of power struggles ends up with the kind of acceptance of not only other people, but more importantly, acceptance of himself for what he is.
Murray, also I think when he comes to that and when he comes to writing this book, even though he doesn't express that much emotion, there's an incredible amount of tenderness coming out.
through all these vignettes.
No, I agree. It's that intimacy. It's really, when you look at this book, you notice there are a lot of these sort of old photographs there. It almost gives you the feeling that you're looking through someone's family album. And that intimacy, that it wasn't done by accident. That wasn't done just to give you an idea of what these picture people look like. You could have lived without knowing what they really look like. What it does is it makes you realize again the consistency of trying to get a glimpse in someone else's life, looking through the calico curtain, getting a chance to sort of feel that the crack of the old dry leather in the family album, the sepia tone photographs. It's all part of that same kind of image. Do you want to say something?
Well, do you think that because his mother always was saying, okay, do something, and he never gave him a chance to, if she had maybe just left him alone for a while, then he would have had a chance to think of something on his own. But since for so long she didn't give him that chance to actually do something, that he kind of thought he didn't let himself make decisions by himself because he had his mom.
Possibly. One of the things I think about the book that's real powerful in terms of its acceptance is that who knows what would have happened if something would have been different. It's more like what happened was the best that could have happened because it's what happened. And it's accepting that leads to a kind of peace and capacity for confidence, which I think is part of that whole story. There's another thing, too, that we haven't talked about, which I think is very prevalent in the book. When I read the book, I kind of had that sweet smell of death throughout the entire book. Now, it starts with his mother fading away and being in the hospital. Obviously, he's going to be dying soon. But the idea of death keeps coming up all the time. We talk about small births and deaths, but the death of his father, the idea of the funeral parlor being over there, the kind of awareness of death of relationship or the struggle, and all that sort of thing keeps happening over and over again. The whole first section of the book is permeated by images and responses to death. I mean sweetness because it's not the kind of death that is filled with a lot of grief, even when he talks about the death of his father. There's a kind of melancholy, a sweet melancholy kind of quality about it. There's
almost nostalgic.
Right. It almost is nostalgic. Where's that? See if I can find some of those wonderful quotes about it. I don't know why I'm having some trouble. Well, one of the things I think that's real important about the whole death of his father is the whole thing about the community and who takes care of the death. This is important in terms of male and female roles, which is a very powerful part of the book. The women do it. As soon as they hear that there's a death in the family, everyone is mobilized. They know it's sort of like a fire drill over here. Everybody knows exactly what they have to do, and it's the women who do it. The cooking begins. The sort of cleaning up the house begins. Where are the men in all this? They don't know what's going on. They're uncomfortable with it. They sort of get dressed up and they kind of hang around with their hands behind their back and kind of talk in low murmurs and let the women take the whole thing over. Men are uncomfortable with the dark side. Men are uncomfortable with this whole idea of death. They want to deny it as best they can. But even so, when he describes that, what is the picture you get of the community? It's sort of a wonderfully sweet kind of thing. It's a, maybe you feel grief and you want to cry, but there's a happiness that's sort of in there as well. That's the kind of sweet smell. And even when he talks about the funeral parlor, what did the guy, his uncle say? He says, it's not the dead people, they don't do anything to you, it's the shrimp. So I've got a million different kind of connotations of things like that. Okay, let me see if there are any other themes I want to do. Oh, yes. The wonder of small things. Mm-hmm. Russell Baker has this beautiful, simplistic language that several of you have brought up that is very misleading. You read it at first and think it's, oh, just a nice little story. And then pretty soon, you kind of understand the juxtaposition of forms and the beauty of it. And the beauty of the whole thing is described through small vignettes, small things, minor occurrences. He only mentions the Depression when he has to. He hardly really mentions anything about the war. He certainly doesn't mention anything of the historical things that are going on very much, except as they affect people in small ways. Which is the other part of the beauty of the book. Is the book starts out after chapter one, which sets the whole thing, in a very small, narrow scope. Little town, way away tucked in the woods. Little Russell Baker, whose experience of life, even his experience of his own father's death, is very intimate, very small scale. It's almost like looking up at all of the adults that are around. You have the feeling that you're at about knee level. And as the book unfolds, so does the scope unfold. You reach out into the world in very gradual steps. First you move, and now you're in a different neighborhood, and then you know about another city and another town. And then you start doubting the relationships around you, your mother you start feeling skeptical about, and your relatives, and you start going out farther and farther, and then you have the issue with the Italians, and then farther and farther still, and then you're in college, and then finally you're sort of out in the world of the Air Force. It's that whole sort of cyclic thing moving out, and what does it do at the very end? He repeats his relationship with his mother through Mimi, and he brings you back to the deathbed one more time. So it's that kind of spiraling structure that kind of helps with that whole thing. The other thing he talks about is the richness of living with disappointments. The whole book is about hopelessness and the quality to survive through hopelessness. He talks that one or several times about talking was what kept people going.
And coffee,
right. And it's a very, very, very powerful kind of image. One of the things that we don't share is that we haven't lived through that kind of hardship. We don't know how that can unite people. And that's what he gives us a very clear picture of, a very kind of powerful community.
Lori, I think the other thing that's just touched on briefly is he feels that it's sort of the end of an era with the coming of the nuclear age. So again, it's a sepia-tone cover, a sepia-tone book, and it's sort of the end of the age of innocence in terms of glorification of war.
Very good point.
Bravery and glory, going out and shooting them, their folks over there that we don't know anything about. So the world, the whole world was just suddenly changed at the end of the book, what was the bomb.
Kind of along that point, he and his mother kind of neglected that change. And he failed and avoided mentioning anything about it in detail at all.
But he implies it there. And by saying it in this one part, basically what it does, it takes the theme of skepticism, now places it in a different arena. It's not his personal skepticism about his parental or role model. It's now the society's skepticism. I think the quote is, "On July 16th, a group of men whose existence was unknown at Whiting Field tested a new weapon in Los Alamos, New Mexico. It worked. For those of us in Florida awaiting our chance at glory, the age of our childhood ended that morning in the premature dawn exploding over the desert. We didn't know about the test, of course. Doors were closing forever on our path, but we could not hear them slam. Soon the world we had known and the values we had lived by in the world would become so obsolete we would seem to Americans of the New Age as quaint as travelers from an antique land." Very powerful and sentimental point of view in terms of the general skepticism that happens. The skepticism now he's talking to his own children about. I'm real glad that you brought that up. Okay. You know about Russell Baker. I think we covered much of this sort of stuff. Did we talk about how melancholy and sad he was? One of the things we learned about Russell Baker is he's a very sad child. One of the things I think that gives us the power of intimacy in the book is that overwhelming kind of hurting that's there. He never really talks directly about his pain. Just a couple times does that word even come up. But he implies that often, certainly because of the power struggle with his mother. But he sort of beats around the bush, which I think makes it a very powerful statement. Because if someone just says, "I was feeling really miserable," you can say, "Yeah, you were feeling miserable," and you move on. But this way, he's always talking about that kind of pain in a real soft, ambiguous way. And it never stops. It starts with grief about not knowing how to deal with his mother. It even ends in a rather humorous way with his mother not even knowing who he is. He also likes to portray himself as a real folksy kind of guy. He's not a pretentious guy. He portrays himself and his background as a real picture of Americana. One thing, too, that struck me back to the sex roles here is his search for male identity. How does he find his male identity, ultimately? Who is the person who is the most important single male role model to him, finally? He struggles and searches. Is it her, do you think? Is that the one you think?
Well, she's always saying how he was a good man.
She's saying it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't experience it. What do you think it is? Excuse me?
It's a double curve.
Russell Baker chooses what as a profession?
Writing.
Harold. Harold is the most significant male role model. I'm going to see if I can find that quote here that sort of talks about it. I only have so many quotes written down that I can't even read my own handwriting here. Harold, 1, 2, 3. I love the language of this book. It is so beautiful. I keep underlining things just because the language is so profound for me. Here it is, here in the middle of the book. I'll just read it here. My first awe of him had softened as I gradually realized his information was not really intended to be information. Gradually, I came to see that Uncle Harold was not a liar, but a teller of stories and romantic. And it was Uncle Harold, the teller of tales, who fascinated me. Though he remained a stern figure, and I never considered sassing him, I saw now that he knew I no longer received his stories with total credulity, but that I was now listening for the pleasure of watching his imagination at play. This change in our relationship seemed to please him. And he goes on and on about how that change affected him personally. Let's see if there's anything else I wanted to talk about here on this theme. Any other issues you guys have in mind? How it felt to you? What kind of issues it raised for you? Talk a little bit about the kind of structure of the book, too, as long as we're talking about humor. Because there's a lot of things that he does here to keep, that ties the book together, makes it a kind of whole experience. It's not just a series of vignettes, although it could have been powerful if it was. Humor is one of the things. He keeps kind of expressing, still a melancholic kind of humor for me. But what other things does he do to help create the kind of the mood, the tone of the book? Remember anything about the structure? Structure is often the hardest thing to kind of talk about. But since you are getting some literature credit, I think I ought to at least touch on it a little bit.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
I don't know. It's a type of book where, you know, I don't really know how to express it, but it was kind of like it was on a straight line the whole book. There was no real point that just really, you know, jumped in. So it kind of made it to me to flow. It was really a flowing book, and so it was easy to read. I like to picture a straight line.
I felt different. I felt like the story wasn't really that long, but every time you brought somebody in, then you jumped back to the beginning of what you knew about them, and you mm-hmm. learned all the way up, and then suddenly you realized you'd read it half a chapter, and then you were back at the same incident. But then you knew why, and then you read, and then you went back to mm-hmm. the next person.
Yeah, it wasn't chronological, or it flashback. Yeah. I guess not chronological, but I think more on the whole tone. I guess tone would be a big.
Maybe what you're saying is there's no climax.
Yeah, that's
for you, for, in terms of the crisis that you resolve.
I saw the climax as, I thought it was very, the story's very circular in its form, both the straight line. And I saw the climax at the very beginning when he's talking about his mother, and then at the very end where he's talking about his mother again. So it starts at that point and comes around. And I think it's so that he's looking at his past and viewing it, and that leads him to his present, and that's climax.
It could be like this.
Yeah, because he uses the term braided cord of humanity a lot.
And with each little birth and death, there's a little climax. He talks about a lot of little births.
those births and deaths were the transitions. A lot of the transitions had to do with moving. Radford's father's death, you know, moving from town to town, moving to different houses. His mother's, the climax of his mother's life was maybe moving to the house of her own, whereas his, I think, came when he asked Mimi, you know, to marry him, and she said, well, are we gonna live with your mother? And, you know, he said, of course not. That was his climactic move, moving out of his mother's house, while at the same time he moved out of his mother's values by deciding he was gonna marry Mimi, who wasn't a good girl. So I think both those moves.
I like how it was really descriptive. Instead of telling you what he thought people were like, he described people by what they did, and then you just figure out what the people were like, instead of a lot of authors that just tell you how it is.
Yeah, real good point. It does make it very powerful. Also, it brings us into the family circle, because then we are there not being narrated to, we are experiencing it at the same time. But I think, right, that sort of, I call it a spiral, but it is a kind of circular thing. He keeps jumping in time, back and forth, and back and forth. He does that so often that it becomes a rhythm. When I read the book, I almost feel a kind of drumbeat of time, the kind of constant rhythm of moving on with the narration, coming back and picking up someone, moving on. Occasionally, even, if he does that with her, he does that with somebody else, or he even tells you how the person dies, jumping ahead in time, as well as back. There's all that kind of juxtaposition of time that really helps flesh out the story in ways that are a little bit unexpected. What other unifying things can we find in the book? I've already talked about some, but I want to sort of reiterate them a bit. The language. I think that, Christine, you mentioned how the book has a kind of tone, a kind of level to it. And I think the way I would describe that would be that his language stays constant. When he's talking about himself as an adult and talking about himself as a little baby, when he's talking about all the various people, even Mimi, he talks about them in a very even tone. The language stays the same. And even when he talks about some very potent times, one time to me that I think is one of the most powerful moments in the book is after he had that, his mother and his grandmother had that real issue about the jelly bread. There was a real power struggle that the mother lost. After his father died, he is, there's that sort of break. They've given Audrey away. And he's a little confused and disoriented, although he doesn't really say that. What does his mother do? Right. He doesn't tell you it's significant. In fact, it ends the chapter. It's not really all that big of a deal. But you realize for his mother, it must have been an incredible big deal. Just like the death of the father and the giving away of Audrey, which he couldn't talk about. You notice that even Baker himself hardly touches on that. All of a sudden, you know that the issue of Audrey was raised. It happened, it was gone, it was over. Because he dealt with that in that very simple way, you're aware of the power of that moment, and it comes back later on, especially when Audrey and Doris are reintroduced to each other. It's interesting, too, who he dedicates the book to. Did you notice? Does anyone notice who he dedicates it to? Doris. The person he doesn't talk about very much at all.
Yeah, I found it fascinating that he didn't talk much about his sister.
But also his sister seemed to have it all in hand. And he didn't feel like he had his son away. I can see why he didn't go into her life.
She had the gumption where he did it.
I felt while I was reading that, you know, so much is happening, moving all over the place, and people coming in and dying, going out and leaving stuff. And, the basic relationship, obviously, is between him and his mother through most of the book, or all of the book, you say, I guess. And it's just so neat that he keeps that constant when everything else is going on and out and through, and all these people are going everywhere. Because I think it would be really chaotic for me to read if it was just him by himself, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as there's him and his mother playing off each other the whole time, it adds some kind of string through the whole thing for me anyway.
Yeah, that's a real good point. It's certainly a unifying element in the whole thing. Mm-hmm.
I found mixed messages with the mother saying, be a man, damn it. And the minute he starts being a man, what happens to her? She just
pull back a little bit.
Well, I have one more question to ask, I think, here, before we close it down. And that is, this obviously is a contemporary book. I mean, it was written contemporarily. What makes this a contemporary book?
I think part of what makes it a contemporary book is that he's looking back. A lot of older, but even autobiographies, is a sort of a chronological dateline of what happened to people. But this is a real examination of what happened to him. And I think that's part of why it's more modern, is that they're really looking, Baker's really trying to find out what his life was really like, not just, and then I moved to New Jersey, to Newark, and then I moved to Baltimore, and then I met Mimi, and then I got married and had kids. It's not, that's not even really significant. It's the trying to find out what the essence of what he's done so far.
I think that's a really good point about the book, but that doesn't make it contemporary, because books like that have been written for the last 100 years.
But she did imply something about the style with which she was writing, too, mm-hmm. and I think maybe some of you could pick up on
what
style.
What exactly do you mean by contemporary? Why
does this speak to our time? What about this book makes it so that it could not have been written 50 years ago?
In other words, if we assigned another autobiography for this class, how would you know that this one, besides the fact that the dates are in the book, how would you know, just reading it, that it's a book of our time rather than a book of your grandparents?
Informal, I mean, he's talking to you. There's not flowery language. It's just, you know, a straight even, here it is, this is what happened, without, you know, trying to impress us with too many big words.
Yeah, I agree with that one.
Sure, it works.
Stark, simple description. I guess, Todd?
Yeah. It asks why, with all of that it goes through, it seems to be going along with what Chris said, where he's giving the reasons for what happened, and that seems to give the reason for his present way that he is. Kind of like his past history is also our past history. Why we do it.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, certainly by implication, that's fair. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Christine, did you ever hear
that? I was just thinking that the struggles in the book are struggles that we can still relate to. And I think they aren't so long ago, and some of the things that he's finding out about himself in what he wrote there, we find out about ourselves, and we can find things out about ourselves.
You can look at it as that's what our parents really went through a lot, and so that might give us, I mean, there must be a lot of relationships, and that might be a good place. But we're starting before we look at our childhood ideals.
I think you also have to think about someone who sits down to write a book. What did he do as a profession? He's a journalist. Is there any way that profession affected this book? What do you mean, simpleness?
Well, a journalist has to be able to express himself in a pretty simple way.
Not so much simple, but I think it's more clear and concise.
Clear, yeah, clear and concise. Mm-hmm. Not elaborate.
He writes for the average person, not for intellectuals or anything, because a journalist has to write for
the majority, yeah.
The majority,
right.
Like he covers so much in so little. He covers the life. Usually read something, some other biography, it may have to be just a part of somebody's life. But I mean, it covers so much. I mean, it keeps moving. It's not never boring, really. It's always, something's always happening, and, you know, that's what keeps my attention.
So you're saying it's very carefully crafted in the way that it's composed.
Mm-hmm.
He's obviously, even though it's very simple language, it's very sophisticated in its
structure.
In its structure.
That's the other thing I wanted to mention about that structure that makes it really contemporary to me is that everything described in the book is in short episodic episodes. It's something that sort of happens, it starts, it stops, maybe it starts again, maybe it starts again, but it's all that sort of stuff is composed in very simple beginning and ending vignettes. Some of them overlap, Some of them continue for a couple chapters, but basically it's in that sort of, you almost expect the commercial to come in. This book could easily be turned into a mini-series, I suppose. And in that sense, it definitely speaks to our contemporary mind, and also is a part of that journalist idea, that there could be a series of articles written over a period of time, daily or weekly or something.
Yeah, and the chapters are pretty short, considering, you know, some books you read in college. And the reading levels, I would say, high school. I mean, there aren't that many words that you don't understand.
That's what makes it contemporary?
Yeah, those things. One other thing I wanted to...
The pacing is like that. It's not necessarily choppy, but it's like a newspaper writer, and you don't have any delayed gratification. It's like a newspaper, or a TV, or a documentary. It all happens really fast, and it's all interesting.
The other thing, too, that's real important about it that makes it contemporary is there isn't that idea of a climax. The idea of the old play where you start reading, you set up the structure, you introduce your characters, you create the main event, you make sure everyone reacts to it, and then somewhere upon the time you resolve it when it's all over, and the climax becomes somewhere usually right before the resolution. This book doesn't have that kind of thing. This book has a very contemporary feel in the sense that it's that cyclic thing that continues on. Mother doesn't die. There's still a whole life he has yet to lead. He doesn't talk about his kids. It's a thing that kind of keeps going. So it gives a kind of
window in time.
Yes, very good. Thank you. A window in time. I wanted to say one more thing about it that I found personally to be the most important part of the feel about it. As I talked about intimacy, and he uses one very easy device. It's something I'll be talking about when we look at visual art to create that intimacy. And it's repetition. He is constantly repeating the same words, the same phrases. He shows you his aunt Pat, who has a couple phrases that she's always using over and over again. And it doesn't take very long before suddenly you are part of the family, because suddenly he says it a couple times, mentions that she repeats it. Yes. And suddenly there, she says it again, and you're right there. You can laugh with the joke in the book. You are a member of the family.
Or grown.
Yeah.
Really.
And he does that in more subtle ways throughout the whole book, which is why the language is such an important part of it.
And I think he's also vulnerable enough to let us know that he is arrogant, or he is ignorant, or he's naive, or he is prejudiced. And I think that takes a really strong writer to be able to portray, on one hand, that he is these things, and on the other hand, the perspective on it for you, at the same time that he's imparting a lot of information. So it's got a sense of humor, and it's got the flashbacks, and it's got the perspective, but it also has that tenderness and that understanding and acceptance of himself.
Anything else anyone want to raise? Any points?
It's an autobiography about someone who, in the vast scheme, overused phrase, of the world, it's inconsequential. His lifetime, you know, he hasn't done anything that great. It's not the autobiography of Ben Franklin. But, I mean, he's just a normal person. But, you know, here we read and we see through this book, his life does have consequence for all of us. Although, you know, who cares about what he did? I mean, but it's what this book shows us and what we feel is consequential.
Yeah, but most of the history courses are something we take. We look at it from Lee's point of view and just see the big people and don't see what's going on in between, so it gives us a little bit better what the people are doing.
Yeah. Right. It's good.
The first time I read this book, I was interested primarily in the events and the personalities, and I remember reacting very strongly to, oh my God, this woman did all this for a house? And then the second time I read it, I picked up on the devices, such as the vignettes, or the starting with a little small detail and building up, and starting with a small detail and building up again, and the flashbacks. So, you know, maybe sometime later on, after this course is long over, you might pick up this book and read a few sections out of it, and remember how vivid and how much you remember, even though, you know, you probably read it fairly quickly. It's really interesting to go back and reread to see how cleverly this is put together. It's very sophisticated in its simplicity.
I would like to add one bit of
advice or warning about the next book for the class. Those of you who have already started have probably realized it's not an easy book to read, especially after Russell Baker. And I think that one of the things I'd like to remind you about is that it's a book that requires a great deal of patience. Don't let yourself get so frustrated that you put it down. And when you're reading some of the visions that are documented there, try and experience them as visions. And don't worry about whether you catch the drift, if you know what the symbology is about. Just give yourself the room to experience them.